Chapter 8. Rendition. From experience to data. You take a picture of them, they'll kill you. They think you're taking something away from them. That you only got so much stuff. And if other people are taking it all, then there ain't none left for yourself. Robert Garland, The Electric Horseman. To photograph is to appropriate the thing photographed. It means putting oneself into a certain relation to the world that feels like knowledge, and therefore, like power. Susan Sontag, on photography. 1. Terms of surrender. We worry about companies that amass our personal data, and we wonder why they should profit. Who owns the data, we ask. But every discussion of data protection or data ownership omits the most important question of all. Why is our experience rendered as behavioral data in the first place? It has been far too easy to overlook this important step in the chain of events that produces behavioral surplus. This chapter and the next draw our attention to the gap between experience and data, as well as to the specific operations that target this gap, on a mission to transform the one into the other. I call these operations rendition. We have seen that the dispossession of human experience is the original sin of surveillance capitalism, but this dispossession is not mere abstraction. Rendition describes the concrete operational practices through which dispossession is accomplished, as human experience is claimed as raw material for datafication and all that follows, from manufacturing to sales. A focus on these intermediate practices illustrates that the apparatus of ubiquity is not a passive one-way mirror. Rather, it actively creates its own stores of knowledge through rendition. The noun rendition derives from the verb render, a most unusual word whose double meanings describe a two-sided equation that perfectly captures what happens in the gap between human experience and behavioral data. On one side of the equation, the verb describes a process in which something is formed out of something else that is originally given. It designates the casual action of turning one thing into another, such as rendering oil from fat, extraction, or rendering an English text from the original Latin, translation. These meanings have also found their way into the vocabulary of digital technology. For example, a rendering engine converts the coded content of an HTML page for display and printing. On the other side of the equation, render also describes the way in which the thing that is changed gives itself over to this process. It surrenders. The verb rendre first appears in 10th century French, meaning to give back, present, yield, as in rendering an account, or the tree renders its fruit. By the 14th century, the word also incorporated the idea of handing over, delivering, or acknowledging dependency or obligation, as in render unto Caesar. These meanings are active today when we say rendering a verdict, rendering service, or rendering property. Surveillance capitalism must work both sides of the equation. On one side, its technologies are designed to render our experience into data, as in rendering oil from fat. This typically occurs outside of our awareness, let alone our consent. On the other side of the equation, every time we encounter a digital interface, we make our experience available to datafication, thus rendering unto surveillance capitalism its continuous tithe of raw material supplies. The two-sided equation is a novel arrangement. As we saw in Chapter 1, the Aware Home Project developed at Georgia Tech just a year before the invention of surveillance capitalism employed different practices that embodied very different assumptions. 1. That it must be the individual alone who decides what experience is rendered as data. 2. That the purpose of the data is to enrich the individual's life. And 3. That the individual is the sole arbiter of how the data are shared or put to use. Nearly two decades later, the Aware home is barely more than an archaeological fragment, reminding us of the road not taken toward an empowering digital future and a more just division of learning in society. Down that road, it is the individual who knows, decides, and decides who decides. An end in herself, not a means to others' ends. The lesson of the Aware home is that there can be rendition without surveillance capitalism. However, the lesson of this chapter and the next is that there can be no surveillance capitalism without rendition. Nothing is exempt, as products and services from every sector join devices like the Nest thermostat in the competition for surveillance revenues. For example, in July 2017, iRobot's autonomous vacuum cleaner, Roomba, made headlines when the company's CEO, Colin Engel, told Reuters about its data-based business strategy for the smart home, starting with a new revenue stream derived from selling floor plans of customers' homes scraped from the machine's new mapping capabilities. Engel indicated that iRobot could reach a deal to sell its maps to Google, Amazon, or Apple within the next 2 years. In preparation for this entry into surveillance competition, a camera, new sensors and software had already been added to Roomba's premier line, enabling new functions, including the ability to build a map while tracking its own location. The market had rewarded iRobot's growth vision, sending the company's stock price to $102 in June 2017 from just $35 a year earlier, translating into a market capitalization of $2.5 billion on revenues of $660 million. Privacy experts raised alarms, knowing that such data streams have virtually no legal or security protection. But Engel assured the public that iRobot would not sell data without its customers' permission and expressed confidence that most would give their consent in order to access the smart home functions. Why was Engel so confident? According to the company's privacy policy, it is true that owners of the Roomba can control or stop the collection of usage data by disconnecting your Wi-Fi or Bluetooth from the app. For example, by changing your Wi-Fi password. However, as Engel told tech site Mashable in July 2017, even when customers do not opt in to the mapping service, the Roomba captures mapping and usage data, but only usage data is sent to the cloud so it can be shown on your mobile device. What Engel neglected to say was that a customer who refuses to share his or her home's interior mapping data with iRobot also loses most of the smart functionality of the autonomous vacuum cleaner, including the ability to use one's phone to start or pause a cleaning, schedule cleanings, review clean map reports, receive automatic software updates, or start a spot clean to focus on a particularly dirty area. Engel's confidence-enhancing strategy goes to the heart of the larger rendition project, for which surveillance capitalist purveyors of smart home products have developed a singular approach. On the one hand, they stress that customers can opt in to data sharing. On the other hand, customers who refuse to opt in face limited product functionality and data security. In these requerimiento-style relationships, instead of the adelantados message, bend the knee or we destroy you, the message here is, bend the knee or we degrade your purchase. Under this new regime, something as simple as buying a mattress now requires careful legal scrutiny of the abusive contracts that nearly everyone ignores. Consider the Sleep Number bed with its smart bed technology and sleep tracking. The company's website features a beautiful couple snuggled in bed, happily glued to their smartphones, as they delight in data from their Sleep IQ app. The bed's base and mattress are customizable, with features that raise or lower the angle of the bed and sensors that soften or firm up the mattress. Other sensors measure heart rate, breathing, and movement. Every morning, you'll get your Sleep IQ score, representing your individual quality and length of sleep, your restful sleep, restless sleep, and time out of bed, and what adjustments you can make. The company suggests that you connect your sleep app to your fitness tracker and your thermostat in order to see how your workout or bedroom temperature affects your sleep. A dense 12-page privacy policy accompanies the bed. Customers are advised that providing information is an affirmation of consent to use that information in line with the policy, which employs the usual onerous terms: third-party sharing, Google Analytics, targeted advertising, and much more. In addition, if customers create a user profile to maximize the effectiveness of the app, the company also collects biometric and sleep-related data about how you, a child, or any person that uses the bed slept, such as that person's movement, positions, respiration, and heart rate while sleeping. It also collects all the audio signals in your bedroom. As with most such policies, customers are advised that the company can share or exploit personal information even after you deactivate or cancel the services and/or your Sleep Number account or user profiles. Customers are warned that no data transmission or storage can be guaranteed to be 100% secure and that it does not honor Do Not Track notifications. Finally, on page 8 of the document, the policy addresses a customer's choices regarding the use of personal information. Whether you submit information to us is entirely up to you. If you decide to not submit information, we may not be able to provide certain features, products, and/or services to you. This same coercive requerimiento twist can be found in the lengthy, dense legal compacts associated with the Alphabet-owned Nest thermostats. The terms of service and end-user licensing agreements reveal oppressive privacy and security consequences in which sensitive information is shared with other devices, unnamed personnel, and third parties for the purposes of analysis and ultimately for trading in behavioral futures markets, action that ricochets back to the owner in the form of targeted ads and messages designed to push more products and services. Despite this, courts have generally upheld companies' claims that they bear no liability without a clear demonstration of economic harm to the consumer. Nest takes little responsibility for the security of that information, and none for how other companies will put it to use. In fact, University of London legal scholars Guido Noto-Ladiega and Ian Walden, who analyzed these documents, reckon that were one to enter into the Nest ecosystem of connected devices and apps, each with their own equally burdensome terms, the purchase of a single home thermostat entails the need to review nearly 1,000 contracts. This absurdity is compounded by the fact that virtually no one reads even one such contract. A valuable empirical study of 543 participants familiar with surveillance and privacy law issues found that when asked to join a new online service, 74% opted for the quick join procedure, bypassing the terms of service agreement and the privacy policy. Among those who did scroll through the abusive contracts, most went directly to the accept button. The researchers calculated that the documents required at least 45 minutes for adequate comprehension. But for those who looked at the agreements, the median time they spent was 14 seconds. Should the customer refuse to agree to Nest's stipulations, the terms of service indicate that the functionality and security of the thermostat itself will be deeply compromised, no longer supported by the necessary updates meant to ensure its reliability and safety. The consequences can range from frozen pipes to failed smoke alarms to an easily hacked internal home system. In short, the effectiveness and safety of the product are brazenly held hostage to its owner's submission to rendition as conquest by and for others' interests. One can easily choose not to purchase a Roomba, a Sleep Number bed, or a Nest thermostat. But each of these is merely emblematic of the immense project of rendition as the first and vital step in the construction of the apparatus of ubiquity. Thousands of Internet of Things objects are becoming available. As Ladiega and Walden conclude, in this new product regime, The simple product functions that we seek are now hopelessly enmeshed in a tangled mixture of software, services, and networks. The very idea of a functional, effective, affordable product or service as a sufficient basis for economic exchange is dying. Where you might least expect it, products of every sort are remade by the new economic requirements of connection and rendition. Each is reimagined as a gateway to the new apparatus, praised for being smart, while traditional alternatives are reviled for remaining dumb. It is important to acknowledge that in this context, smart is a euphemism for rendition. Intelligence that is designed to render some tiny corner of lived experience as behavioral data. Each smart object is a kind of marionette. For all its smartness, it remains a hapless puppet dancing to the puppet master's hidden economic imperatives. Products, services, and applications march to the drumbeat of inevitabilism, toward the promise of surveillance revenues hacked from the still wild spaces that we call my reality, my home, my life, and my body. Every smart product repeats our essential questions. What does a smart product know, and whom does it tell? Who knows? Who decides? Who decides who decides? Examples of products determined to render, monitor, record, and communicate behavioral data proliferate, from smart vodka bottles to internet-enabled rectal thermometers, and quite literally, everything in between. The business developer for a spirits company thus cites his plan for a connected bottle. The more we learn about consumers and their behaviors, the better services we can connect to them. Many brands are determined to give packaging a speaking role in an increasingly interactive marketplace. Global spirits distributor Diageo promises smart sensor-equipped bottles that can track purchases and sales data and, most importantly, communicate with consumers' devices and switch gears, recipes versus sales promos, once the bottle is opened. A producer of bar equipment states the case plainly enough. It really is all about allowing these bar owners to see stuff that they couldn't see before and maximize their profits. Today, our homes are in surveillance capitalism's crosshairs as competitors chased a $14.7 billion market for smart home devices in 2017, up from $6.8 billion just a year earlier, and expected to reach more than $101 billion by 2021. You may have already encountered some of the early absurdities. Smart toothbrushes, smart light bulbs, smart coffee mugs, smart ovens, smart juicers, and smart utensils said to improve your digestion. Others are often more grim. A home security camera with facial recognition. An alarm system that monitors unusual vibrations before a break-in occurs. Indoor GPS locators. Sensors that attach to any object to analyze movement, temperature, and other variables. Every kind of connected appliance. Cyborg cockroaches designed to detect sound. Even the baby's nursery is reconceived as a source of fresh behavioral surplus. An appreciation of the surveillance logic of accumulation that drives this action suggests that this network of things is already evolving into a network of coercion, in which mundane functions are ransomed for behavioral surplus. A December 2013 letter from Google's finance director to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission's Division of Corporate Finance provides a vivid glimpse of these facts. The letter was composed in response to an SEC query on the segmentation of Google's revenues between its desktop and mobile platforms. Google answered by stating that users would be viewing our ads on an increasingly wide diversity of devices in the future, and that its advertising systems were therefore moving toward device-agnostic design that made segmentation irrelevant and impractical. A few years from now, the letter stated, we and other companies could be serving ads and other content on refrigerators, car dashboards, thermostats, glasses, and watches, to name just a few possibilities. Here is at least one endgame. The smart home and its Internet of Things are the canvas upon which the new markets in future behavior inscribe their presence and assert their demands in our most intimate spaces. Key to the story is that all of this action is prosecuted in support of a larger market process that bets on the future of our behavior and over which we have no knowledge or control. Each node in the network, the vacuum cleaner, the mattress, the thermostat, must play its part, beginning with the frictionless rendition of behavior as the whole team of seething, insistent smart things joins the migration to surveillance revenues. As we are shorn of alternatives, we are forced to purchase products that we can never own, while our payments fund our own surveillance and coercion. Adding insult to injury, data rendered by this wave of things are notoriously insecure and easily subject to breaches. Moreover, manufacturers have no legal responsibility to notify device owners when data are stolen or hacked. There are other, even more grandiose ambitions for the rendition of all solitary things. Companies such as Qualcomm, Intel, and ARM are developing tiny, always-on, low-power computer vision modules that can be added to any device, such as your phone, or refrigerator, or any surface. A Qualcomm executive says that appliances and toys can now know what's going on around them. A doll could detect when a child's face turns toward it. Consider Smart Skin, developed by brilliant university scientists and now poised for commercial elaboration. Initially valued for its ability to monitor and diagnose health conditions, from Parkinson's disease to sleep disorders, Smart Skin is now hailed for its promise of ultra-unobtrusive ubiquity. Researchers at Georgia Tech developed a version of Smart Skin that sucks energy from radio waves and other energy sources, eliminating the need for batteries. Smart Skin, described as the ultimate sensing tool that could potentially allow for the mass implementation of perpetual wireless networks, can cognize, sense, analyze, wirelessly communicate, and modify parameters using simple radio frequency, RFID technology. As in the case of Paradiso's sensor tape, the researchers stress that it can also be applied everywhere to monitor, sense, and interact with the world around us in a perpetual way, thus significantly enhancing ambient intelligence, all of it as inconspicuous as a decal sticker. They suggest, for example, the shelves of grocery stores, where revenue opportunities are plentiful. Rendition has become a surveillance capitalist project shaped by its imperatives and directed toward its objectives. In the composition of the shadow text, rendition is step one. The concrete operationalization of the original sin of simple robbery that defined this market project from the start. Google rendered the earth, its streets, and its dwelling places, bypassing our consent and defying our protests. Facebook rendered the social network and its limitless details for the sake of the company's behavioral futures markets. Now the ubiquitous apparatus is the means to the ubiquitous rendition of human experience. We have seen the urgency with which surveillance capitalists pursue the elimination of friction as a critical success factor in supply operations. The prediction imperative makes boundaries and borders intolerable, and surveillance capitalists will do almost anything to eliminate them. This pursuit transforms connection into a commercial imperative and transforms individual autonomy into a threat to surveillance revenues. Surveillance capitalism's rendition practices overwhelm any sensible discussion of opt-in and opt-out. There are no more fig leaves. The euphemisms of consent can no longer divert attention from the bare facts. Under surveillance capitalism, rendition is typically unauthorized, unilateral, gluttonous, secret, and brazen. These characteristics summarize the asymmetries of power that put the surveillance in surveillance capitalism. They also highlight a harsh truth. It is difficult to be where rendition is not. As industries far beyond the technology sector are lured by surveillance profits, the ferocity of the race to find and render experience as data has turned rendition into a global project of surveillance capital. This chapter and the next survey a range of rendition activities in the pursuit of economies of scope. The remainder of this chapter concentrates on extension, the first dimension of scope, as rendition operations move into the real world, seizing fresh, unexpected chunks of human experience. Extension wants every corner and crevice, every utterance and gesture on the path to dispossession. All that is moist and alive must hand over its facts. There can be no shadow, no darkness. This unknown is intolerable. The solitary is forbidden. Later in Chapter 9, we move into the depth dimension. The net is cast wide over the waters of daily life, but there are also submarines exploring the depths in search of new sources of surplus prized for their rare predictive powers. Your personality, emotions, and endorphins. The examples in these chapters are not intended to be exhaustive, but rather to illustrate the seriousness of purpose, tenacity, and subterfuge with which surveillance capitalists pursue their search for new aspects of human experience that can be monetized as certainty. In this pursuit, we are necessarily involved in citing specific actors, products, and techniques, knowing that the details of persons and companies are constantly churning. Firms will be bought and sold, fail or succeed. People will come and go. Specific technologies, products, and techniques will be abandoned, refined, and surpassed. When they fall, new ones will take their place, as long as surveillance capitalism is allowed to flourish. Velocity and churn have been critical to surveillance capitalism's success, and we cannot allow the constant movement to inhibit our determination to grasp the laws of motion that command this roiling landscape. It is the pattern and its purpose that we want to grasp. 2. Body rendition. The rendition of your body begins quite simply with your phone. Even when your city is not smart or owned and operated by Google, market players with an interest in your behavior know how to find your body. For all of the elaborate ways in which surveillance capitalists labor to render reality as behavior for surplus, the simplest and most profound is their ability to know exactly where you are all the time. Your body is reimagined as a behaving object to be tracked and calculated for indexing and search. Most smartphone apps demand access to your location, even when it's not necessary for the service they provide, simply because the answer to this question is so lucrative. Location data can be extracted from geotags, created when your smartphone automatically embeds your identity and location in photos and videos. Retailers use geofencing to demarcate a geographical area and send alerts to smartphones within those parameters. Come here now, buy this here, an offer just for you. Download the Starbucks app and then leave your house if you want to see this in action. As one marketing consultancy advises, mobile advertising, the ultimate form of geotargeting, is the holy grail of advertising. Tips and tricks for location-based marketing are generously offered by a firm that specializes in mobile advertising. It allows you to tap into people's compulsive nature by encouraging impulse buys with the notifications you send out. It also allows you to gain insight on your current customers by reading what they're saying on Yelp and Facebook. Another mobile marketing firm recommends life pattern marketing based on techniques derived from military intelligence known as patterns of life analysis. These involve gathering location and other data from phones, satellites, vehicles, and sensors to assemble intelligence on the daily behavioral patterns of a person of interest in order to predict future behavior. Marketers are exhorted to map the daily patterns of a target audience in order to intercept people in their daily routines with brand and promotional messages. As the firm emphasizes, the psychological power of the perception of ubiquity is profound. Life pattern marketing forms a powerful psychological imprint on consumers. You can shut down the GPS locator on your phone, but most people do not, both because they rely on its utilities, and because they are ignorant of its operations. According to Pew Research, 74% of U.S. smartphone owners in 2003 used apps that required location data, and 90% did so in 2015. That's about 153 million people, more than those who listen to music or watch video on their phones. Surveillance capitalism's reliance on secret operations means that most of us simply do not and cannot know the extent to which our phone doubles as a tracking device for corporate surveillance. A study by researchers at Carnegie Mellon University proves the point efficiently. During a 3-week period, 23 participants were continuously informed of the number of apps accessing their location information and the total number of accesses in a given period. They were flabbergasted by the sheer volume of the onslaught as they each variously learned that their locations were accessed 4,182 times, 5,398 times, 356 times, and so on over a 14-day period, all for the sake of advertisers, insurers, retailers, marketing firms, mortgage companies, and anyone else who pays to play in these behavioral markets. As one participant summed it up, "It felt like I'm being followed by my own phone. It's scary." 58% of participants subsequently restricted the permissions granted to their mobile apps. Unsurprisingly, Google represents the vanguard of location-based tracking. A 2016 affidavit from law enforcement officials seeking a search warrant for a California bank robber made plain why Google location data are unparalleled. Google collects and retains location data from Android-enabled mobile devices. Google collects this data whenever one of their services is activated and/or whenever there is an event on the mobile device, such as a phone call, text messages, internet access, or email access. The officials on the case requested location information from Google because it offers far more detail than even the phone companies can provide. The location systems in Android combine cell tower data with GPS, Wi-Fi networks, and other information culled from photos, videos, and other sources. That lets Android pinpoint users to a single building rather than a city block. In November 2017, Quartz investigative reporters discovered that since early 2017, Android phones had been collecting location information by triangulating the nearest cell towers, even when location services were disabled, no apps were running, and no carrier SIM card was installed in the phone. The information was used to manage Google's push notifications and messages sent to users on their Android phones, enabling the company to track whether an individual with an Android phone or running Google apps had set foot in a specific store, and use that to target the advertising a user subsequently sees. Google's location history system is a product of the corporation's global mapping operations. Though active for over a decade, it was unveiled to the public only in 2015 as Your Timeline, a feature that allows you to visualize your real-world routines. The corporation calculated that any negative reaction to the volume and persistence of tracking revealed by Timeline would be mitigated by the value of users' active contributions to their own stocks of behavioral surplus as they fine-tune the information, add relevant photos, insert comments, and so forth. This was represented as an individual's investment in personalized services such as Google Now, so that it might more effectively comb your email and apps in order to push relevant traffic and weather updates, notifications, suggestions, and reminders. Location data is the quid pro quo for these services. Your transaction is greased by the universal promises of privacy and control. Your timeline is private and visible only to you, and you control the locations you choose to keep. But Google uses your location data to target ads. Indeed, these are among the most significant sources of surplus in Google's advertising markets, with a direct impact on click rates. The standard account from Google and other surveillance capitalists is that behavioral surplus is retained only as metadata, which are then aggregated across large numbers of individual users. We are told that it's not possible to identify individuals from these large-scale amalgamations. However, with as little as 3 bits of data easily culled from the public record, birth date, zip code, and sex, re-identification science has demonstrated its ability to de-anonymize metadata with disturbing ease. In a summary of this research, legal scholar Paul Ohm writes that re-identification makes all our secrets fundamentally easier to discover and reveal. Our enemies will find it easier to connect us to facts that they can use to blackmail, harass, defame, frame, or discriminate against us. This mistake pervades nearly every information privacy law. Regarding the massive caches of supposedly anonymous behavior surplus, Ohm calls them databases of ruin. When it comes to location data, the situation is just as bad. In 2013, a group of MIT and Harvard computer scientists demonstrated that because individuals tend to have idiosyncratic mobility signatures, any analyst with the right tools can easily extract the mobility pattern of a specific individual within a large anonymized data set of location metadata. Another research team demonstrated that data collected by seemingly innocuous smartphone-embedded sensors, such as accelerometers, gyroscopes, and magnetometers, can be used to infer an ever-growing range of human activities and even moods. Their work also shows that these sensor data can be used to obtain sensitive information about specific users from anonymized datasets. Companies are putting these surveillance capabilities to work. Broadcom produced a global navigation satellite system in a chip that combines satellite communications with the sensors in your cell phone to create a positioning engine that can find your location even if you are not connected to a network, including your location in a building, how many steps you've taken, in what direction, at what altitude. All this depends solely on one factor, says a company vice president, the device in your hand. Princeton computer scientists Arvind Narayanan and Edward Felton summed it up this way. There is no known effective method to anonymize location data, and no evidence that it's meaningfully achievable. Even without de-anonymization, location metadata constitute an unrivaled concentration of knowledge within private firms and an extraordinary advantage in the division of learning. In 2016, Chinese search engine Baidu, often referred to as the Google of China, announced that its big data lab uses location data from its 600 million users to track and predict the dynamics of the Chinese economy. The company built an employment index for the national economy, as well as a consumption index. It also touted its ability to generate quite specific predictions, such as Apple's second quarter earnings in China that year. To the best of our knowledge, Baidu researchers wrote, "We are the first to measure the second largest economy by mining such unprecedentedly large-scale and fine granular spatial-temporal data." As powerful as location data are, wearable technologies and their applications are another significant proving ground in the act of body rendition. One 2017 report describes a new generation of wearables armed with more sensors and smarter algorithms focused on biometric monitoring and body parts as conduits for data collection. These complex sensors can access environmental context, smells, emotional state. Google has developed internet-enabled fabrics, claiming that it aims to bring inductive yarns to every garment and fabric on Earth. If you can weave the sensor into the textile, as a material, explains project leader Ivan Puparev, you're moving away from the electronics. You're making the basic materials of the world around us interactive. A partnership with Levi Strauss has already yielded interactive denim, including a jacket first brought to market in September 2017. The material is described as able to infer behavior in order to be interactive yet authentic. The jacket contains sensors that can see through the fabric to detect and decipher gestures as subtle as the twitch of your finger. There is a numbing repetition of McKay's themes throughout the literature on wearables. Just as he insisted that telemetric devices must operate outside the awareness of unrestrained animals, today's developers stress that wearables must be unobtrusive to avoid raising alarm. They are to be continuous, pervasive, and crucially low-cost in order to achieve economies of scope. The digital marketing firm Ovum forecasts 650 million wearables by 2020, nearly double the number used in 2016, and its research suggests that growth is largely driven by the lure of surveillance revenues. Mobile advertisers, they report, see wearables as a source of very granular data insights, and also new types of behavioral and usage data. Wearables of the future will have the ability to capture a wide array of data related to users' contextual activity, health, and emotional state. This information can be used to enhance and tailor both products and marketing messages to a very high degree. Healthcare is an especially active proving ground for wearable sensored technologies, a development that's particularly pernicious given the more innocent origins of this idea. When telemetry first shifted from McKay's gaggles, flocks, and herds to the human animal, one of its first applications was as a means to oversee the vulnerable in the form of push-button pendants for elderly people alone in their homes. In 2002, the year that a still-secret surveillance capitalism achieved its first breakthroughs, a review of wireless telemedicine stressed the value of home monitoring for the elderly and for the expansion of health services in remote areas. As in the case of the Aware Home, a diagram of the proposed digital architecture for such home monitoring services features only three parties: a closed loop that exclusively links a patient at home, her hospital's servers, and her physician. There are no extra parties imagined in either of these designs, no companies capturing your behavior, no behemoth tech firms with their porous platforms and proprietary servers transforming your life into surplus so they can make a book on what you will do next and enable their customers to sell it to you first. Before the birth and spread of surveillance capitalism, it was possible to imagine digital representations of your body as an enrichment of the intimate relationships between a patient and a trusted doctor, a mother and her child, elderly parents and their adult children. As surveillance capitalism overwhelms the digital milieu, that vision has been made ridiculous. Both the Aware Home and the telemedicine design assume that all behavioral data are reinvested in service to the human being who is the subject of these arrangements, providing serenity, trust, and dignity, a chance for real knowledge and empowerment. Many articles on health monitoring continue to emphasize its utility for the elderly, but the conversation has decisively moved on from this earlier state of grace. Some researchers anticipate the fusion of smart cities and what's now called mHealth to produce smart health, defined as the provision of health services by using the context-aware network and sensing infrastructure of smart cities. Toward that end, there are now reliable sensors for rendering an increasing range of physiological processes as behavioral data, including body temperature, heart rate, brain activity, muscle motion, blood pressure, sweat rate, energy expenditure, and body and limb motion. There are sensors that can render audio, visual, and physiological data during post-surgical patient recovery and rehabilitation. A flexible sensored textile patch has been developed that can render breathing, hand movements, swallowing, and walking as behavioral data. In other applications, wearable micro-machined sensors provide accurate biomechanical analysis as you walk or run, and a body area network records and analyzes walking and running under extreme conditions. It is eloquent testimony to the healthcare system's failure to serve the needs of second modernity individuals that we now access health data and advice from our phones, while these pocket computers aggressively access us. mHealth has triggered an explosion of rendition and behavioral surplus capture as individuals turn in record numbers to their fitness bands and diet apps for support and guidance. By 2016, there were more than 100,000 mobile health apps available on the Google Android and Apple iOS platforms, double the number in 2014. These rich data can no longer be imagined as cloistered within the intimate closed loops between a patient and her doctor, or between an application and its dieters or runners. That bucolic vision has its holdouts, to be sure. But for surveillance capitalists, this vision is but a faded daguerreotype. In the U.S., most health and fitness applications are not subject to health privacy laws, and the laws that do exist do not adequately take into account either new digital capabilities or the ferocity of surveillance capitalist operations. Companies are expected to self-regulate by following guidelines suggested by the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, and other government agencies. For example, in 2016, the FTC issued a list of best practices for developers of mobile health applications aimed at increasing transparency, privacy, and security. Among these suggestions, developers are encouraged to make sure your app doesn't access consumer information it doesn't need. Let consumers select particular contacts, rather than having your app request access to all user contacts through the standard API. And let users choose privacy-protective default settings. That year, the Food and Drug Administration announced that it would also not seek to regulate health and fitness apps, citing their low-level risk. Instead, the agency released its own set of voluntary guidelines for software developers. The agency's well-meaning guidelines overlook the inconvenient truth that transparency and privacy represent friction for surveillance capitalists in much the same way that improving working conditions, rejecting child labor, and shortening the workday represented friction for the early industrial capitalists. It took targeted laws to change working conditions back then, not suggestions. Then, as now, the problems to which these pleas for self-restraint are addressed cannot be understood as excesses, mistakes, oversights, or lapses of judgment. They are necessitated by the reigning logic of accumulation and its relentless economic imperatives. A legal review of mobile health apps concludes that most of them take the consumer's private information and data without the consumer's permission, and do not generally disclose to the user that this information will be sent to advertising companies. These conclusions are borne out by a long queue of studies, but let's focus on a 2016 in-depth investigation by scholars from the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto in association with Open Effect, a nonprofit focused on digital privacy and security. This study looked at the collection, processing, and usage activities associated with 9 fitness trackers. 7 were chosen for their popularity, 1 was made by a Canadian company, and the 9th was an app that specialized in women's health. All but 2 apps transmitted every logged fitness event to the company's servers, which enabled backup and sharing with one's friends, but also data analytics and distribution to third parties. Some of the trackers transmitted device identification numbers. Others passively and continuously transmitted the user's precise longitude and latitude coordinates. These identifiers could link fitness and biographical data to a single mobile phone hardware or single specific fitness wearable. None of this sensitive information was necessary for the tracker to operate effectively, and most of the privacy policies were opaque at best, and allowed data to be sold or exchanged with third parties. As we know, once a third party captures your surplus, it is shared with other third parties, who share with other third parties, and so on. The team also examined the tracker's transmission of the Bluetooth Media Access Controller, or MAC, address that is unique to each phone. When this address is publicly discoverable, any third party with an interest in your movements, retailers who want to know your mall activity, Insurers concerned about your compliance with an exercise regime can persistently track your phone. Mobile data sets logged over time can be combined to form a fine-grained picture of your movements, enabling targeted applications and heightening the probability of guaranteed outcomes. The only real protection is when an app randomly but regularly generates a new MAC address for your phone. But of the 9 trackers, only Apple's performed this operation. The report also identifies a general pattern of careless security, as well as the ability to generate false data. The researchers observed that consumers are likely to be misled and confused, overestimating the extent of security measures and underestimating the breadth of personal data collected by fitness tracking companies. As they concluded, "We discovered severe security vulnerabilities, incredibly sensitive geolocation transmissions that serve no apparent benefit to the end user, and policies leaving the door open for the sale of users' fitness data to third parties without express consent of the users." If you are inclined to dismiss this report because fitness trackers can be written off as toys, let's consider a look at an incisive investigation into Android-based diabetes apps in a 2016 Journal of American Medicine research report, and with it, ample illustration of the frenzy of body rendition. The researchers note that although the FDA approved the prescription of a range of apps that transmit sensitive health data, the behind-the-scenes practices of these apps are understudied. They examined 211 diabetes apps and randomly sampled 65 of them for close analysis of data transmission practices. Among these apps, merely downloading the software automatically authorized collection and modification of sensitive information. The researchers identified a great deal of backstage action, including apps that modify or delete your information, 64%, read your phone status and identity, 31%, gather location data, 27%, view your Wi-Fi connections, 12%, and activate your camera in order to access your photos and videos, 11%. Between 4% and 6% of the apps went even further, reading your contact lists, calling phone numbers found in your device, modifying your contacts, reading your call log, and activating your microphone to record your speech. Finally, the research team unearthed an even darker secret. Privacy policies do not matter. Of the 211 apps in the group, 81% did not have privacy policies. But for those that did, not all of the provisions actually protected privacy. Of those apps without privacy policies, 76% shared sensitive information with third parties. And of those with privacy policies, 79% shared data, while only about half admitted doing so in their published disclosures. In other words, privacy policies are more aptly referred to as surveillance policies, and that is what I suggest we call them. There are many new territories of body rendition. Organs, blood, eyes, brain waves, faces, gait, posture. Each of these expresses the same patterns and purpose that we have seen here. The surveillance capitalists relentlessly fight any attempts to constrain rendition. The ferocity with which they claim their right to rendition out of thin air is ample evidence of its foundational importance in the pursuit of surveillance revenues. This ferocity is well illustrated in surveillance capitalists' determination to discourage, eliminate, or weaken any laws governing the rendition of biometric information, especially facial recognition. Because there is no federal law in the U.S. that regulates facial recognition, these battles occur at the state level. Currently, the Illinois Biometric Privacy Act offers the most comprehensive legal protections, requiring companies to obtain written consent before collecting biometric information from any individual, and, among other stipulations, granting individuals the right to sue a company for unauthorized rendition. The Center for Public Integrity, along with journalists, privacy advocates and legal scholars, has documented the active opposition of surveillance capitalists to the Illinois law and similar legislative proposals in other states. With its unique competitive advantages in facial recognition, Facebook is considered the most uncompromising of all the tech companies when it comes to biometric data, described as working feverishly to prevent other states from enacting a law like the one in Illinois. Facebook's considerable political muscle had been cultivated in just a few years as it learned to emulate Google's playbook of political and cultural fortifications. The company's founder, Mark Zuckerberg, demonstrated an iron determination to preserve his freedom in lawless space, pushing the boundaries of existing regulations and vigorously opposing even the whisper of new law. Between 2009 and 2017, the company increased its lobbying spending by a factor of 50, building a massive lobbying entourage of Washington power brokers. Facebook's $4.6 million in donations during the 2016 election cycle complemented its lobbying budget of $11.5 million in 2017. Zuckerberg's advantages in biometrics are significant. In 2017, Facebook boasted 2 billion monthly users uploading 350 million photos every day, a supply operation that the corporation's own researchers refer to as practically infinite. In 2018, a Facebook research team announced that it had closed the gap and was now able to recognize faces in the wild with 97.35% accuracy, closely approaching human-level performance. The report highlights the corporation's supply and manufacturing advantages, especially the use of deep learning based on large training sets. Facebook announced its eagerness to use facial recognition as a means to more powerful ad targeting, but even more of the uplift would come from the immense machine training opportunities represented by so many photos. By 2018, its machines were learning to discern activities, interests, mood, gaze, clothing, gait, hair, body type, and posture. The marketing possibilities are infinite. It should not surprise any student of the prediction imperative that, with these advantages in hand, Facebook is unwilling to accept anything less than total conquest in its bid to render faces for the sake of more lucrative prediction products. So far, Facebook and its brethren have been successful, turning back legislative proposals in Montana, New Hampshire, Connecticut, and Alaska, and fatally weakening a bill that was passed in Washington state. Among the tech companies, only Facebook continued to oppose even the diminished terms of the Washington legislation. If rendition is interrupted, surveillance capitalism cannot stand, for the whole enterprise rests on this original sin. This fact is amply displayed in the public drama surrounding the ill-fated 2015 attempt to produce public guidelines on the creation and use of biometric information through a voluntary, privacy multi-stakeholder process convened by the National Telecommunications and Information Association, NTIA, under the auspices of the U.S. Department of Commerce. After weeks of negotiations, consumer advocates walked out in protest over the hard-line position of the tech companies and their lobbyists on the single most pivotal issue, consent. The companies insisted on their right to use facial recognition systems to identify a stranger on the street without first obtaining the individual's consent. As one lobbyist in the talks told the press, "Everyone has the right to take a photograph in public. If someone wants to apply facial recognition, should they really need to get consent in advance?" Privacy scholars were quick to respond that there is no lawfully established right to such actions, let alone a First Amendment right. Nobody reckoned with the fact that the prediction imperative makes individual ignorance the preferred condition for rendition operations, just as Arendt had observed and McKay had prescribed for animals in the wild. Original sin prefers the dark. The talks continued without the advocates, and in 2016, the NTIA issued its Privacy Best Practice Recommendations for Commercial Facial Recognition Use. The guidelines should be understood as the best for the surveillance capitalists, but as the worst for everyone else. In the language of these guidelines, the tech companies, retailers, and others determined to chase surveillance revenues are simply encouraged to make their policies on facial recognition available to consumers in a reasonable manner. Where companies impose facial recognition on a physical location, they are encouraged to provide notice to consumers. Rendition operations are tacitly accorded legitimacy, not only in the lack of contest, but because they stand as the immovable facts draped in the cheap garlands of toothless best practices. Georgetown University legal scholar Alvaro Bedoya, a member of the advocacy group that quit the deliberations, blasted the recommendations as a mockery of the fair information practice principles on which they claim to be grounded. They offer no real protection for individuals and cannot be taken seriously. Under the regime of surveillance capitalism, individuals do not render their experience out of choice or obligation, but rather out of ignorance and the dictatorship of no alternatives. The ubiquitous apparatus operates through coercion and stealth. Our advance into life necessarily takes us through the digital, where involuntary rendition has become an inescapable fact. We are left with few rights to know, or to decide who knows, or to decide who decides. This abnormal division of learning is created and sustained by secret fiat, implemented by invisible methods, and directed by companies bent to the economic imperatives of a strange new market form. Surveillance capitalists impose their will backstage, while the actors perform the stylized lullabies of disclosure and agreement for the public. The prediction imperative transforms the things that we have into things that have us, in order that it might render the range and richness of our world, our homes, and our bodies as behaving objects for its calculations and fabrications on the path to profit. The chronicles of rendition do not end here, however. Act 2 requires a journey from our living rooms and streets to another world below the surface where inner life unfolds.